Hello everyone. Continuing with New Human Revolution Volume 1, Chapter 4, Light of Compassion, we'll be starting on page 260 and reading up to 284, which is somewhere in between this Chapter 5 Pioneers. So let's begin. Aisuke Akizuki's face brightened. Ultimately, Shinichi continued. Whether we can keep innovating our newspaper depends solely upon whether our writers can keep innovating their personal determination. We could have thousands or tens of thousands of journalists, but if they forget the spirit of challenging themselves and instead become stagnant, failing to make creative efforts and performing their work passively, then it will be impossible for the Seikyo Shimbun to compete with the world's leading newspapers. What we need are writers with unsurpassed, lion-like courage, who are prepared to bear full responsibility for the Sokagakai and take up their pens with a resolve to change the world. If we have just 5 or 10 such journalists, then that's all we need. Success in communicating our message through speech or writing does not depend on the number of people involved. Becoming an internationally respected newspaper means producing journalists who are all internationally respected. Let's raise writers of true caliber. After all, the struggle for Kosen Rufu is waged through the written and spoken word. Full responsibility for the Seikyo Shimbun effectively rested on the shoulders of managing editor Aisuki Akizuki. In addition to carrying out pivotal activities as the Soka Gakkai division chief, Akizuki also earnestly poured his energies into the production of each issue of the Soka Gakkai's newspaper. And as one of the leaders accompanying Shinichi Yamamoto on this overseas trip, he did his utmost to guide and encourage the members. At the same time, he took photos and wrote articles, often staying up until dawn to complete them, then posting his work to the Seikyo Shimbun headquarters in Japan. In the months since the inauguration of President Yamamoto and the opening of a new era for the Soka Gakkai, Akizuki had given deep thought to the future of the Seikyo Shimbun. But it had been like feeling his way through a heavy mist. He had found it impossible to form a clear vision. Sensing Akizuki's dilemma, Shinichi had taken time to speak with him at length about the Seikyo Shimbun on this day. In 10 or 15 years from now, Shinichi continued, still voicing his hopes for the future, the Seikyo Shimbun will steadily dispatch reporters and correspondents overseas. The day will also surely come when it will be quite commonplace for our writers to interview heads of state and leading scholars in many fields, confidently discussing with them the pacifistic philosophy and ideals of Buddhism. Let's also solicit articles from outstanding world leaders in all spheres of human endeavor, and strive together with them to find the path to lasting peace. Imagine how exciting that will be. Yes, responded Akizuki with a smile. Listening to Shinichi outline his hopes and dreams for the Seikyo Shimbun, Akizuki felt as if a ray of light had illuminated the future. The clouds had been swept from his heart, and he felt lighter in both body and mind. Akizuki set off for New York, deeply encouraged. After he saw Aisuki Akizuki off, Shinichi Yamamoto joined the other leaders for a tour of the city of Washington, D.C. The clear blue sky made a stunning backdrop for the gleaming white buildings that stood along streets lined with shady trees, beginning to show the first signs of autumn. Washington, D.C. was a capital renowned for some of the finest parks in the world. Thus, it was a city where architecture and nature blended in splendid harmony. The party visited the Capitol, the White House, the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, and other sites of interest. With the imminent construction of the Grand Reception Hall at the Head Temple, they all took a keen interest in these buildings. They were especially captivated by the Lincoln Memorial, its marble columns and steps resembling a classic Greek temple. It has a wonderful grandeur, doesn't it? Said Kiyoshi Jujo admiringly. Yes, it certainly conveys strength. It would be great to incorporate this kind of style into the grand reception hall, said Shinichi, gazing up at the memorial. I think that should be possible. I'll have a talk with the architects, said Jujo happily, making a note in his book. Shinichi's proposal was later realized in the form of the great stone steps at the entrance of the grand reception hall. The group then walked along the tidal basin, the name given to the area around the banks of a lake fed by the Potomac River. The autumn breeze felt pleasant on their faces. Cherry trees fringed the edge of the tidal basin, and the white dome of the Jefferson Memorial, gleaming in the sunlight, was visible on the opposite bank. Stained a deep reddish brown, the leaves of the cherries were beginning to fall. How beautiful it must be in the spring when the trees proudly displayed their blossoms in full bloom. I'd love to come here when the cherries are in bloom, Shinichi remarked. These cherry trees, Katsukiyara explained, were planted at the request of Helen Taft, the wife of the 27th U.S. president. Perhaps you already know the history. When his husband was inaugurated as president, she supervised the development of Potomac Park and came up with the idea of planting Japanese cherry trees. I see you've been doing your homework, said Shinichi. Yes, Kiyohara admitted. This story is well known, Shinichi observed. Mrs. Taft sent a request to Japan for the cherry trees, and, if I remember correctly, the then mayor of Tokyo, Yukio Ozaki, readily responded to her request. Yes, in January 1912, he sent some 3,000 cherry tree saplings as a token of U.S.-Japan friendship, Kiyohara added, smiling. Katsu Kiyohara continued to speak knowledgeably on the origin of the cherry trees of Washington, D.C. The cherry tree saplings sent by Yukio Ozaki arrived safely in the American capital. First Lady Helen Taft and the wife of the Japanese ambassador to the United States planted the first two saplings. As the years passed and the trees took root and began to bloom, they became a popular attraction, with many people coming to view the cherry blossoms each year. The trees came to be loved not only by the citizens of Washington, but by many throughout the United States. Later, between 300 and 400 of these trees were slated to be cut down to make way for the construction of the Jefferson Memorial. The people of Washington, however, organized a protest and finally succeeded in forcing the city authorities to change their plans. As a result, only a small portion of the original number of trees had to be cut down. That's a wonderful story, Shinichi said after Kiyohara had finished. The garden of the house where I lived as a child in Kojiya, in Tokyo's Kamamata Ward, also had a big cherry tree. Our family later moved away, but towards the end of the war, I had occasion to visit the neighborhood again. It had been quite some time since I was there last. When I stopped by the house in which we had once lived, I found that it had been converted into a munitions factory. The house had been demolished, and the cherry tree that had stood in the large garden had been cut down. The hearts of people had been so bitterly wounded by war that they probably had no time to think of cherry blossoms. I remember standing there, overwhelmed by a sense of loss and sadness. Shortly after that, the great air raids began over Tokyo, and many people were burned out of their homes. The entire landscape was turned into a hellish, blackened wasteland. But in one corner of the city, there remained several cherry trees that bore fragrant blossoms. The sky was a dazzling blue, and the branches of these magnificent cherry trees, heavy with blossoms in full bloom, swayed with regal serenity in the spring breeze. In the dark, chaotic days of the war, they seemed to me to radiate with the light of hope. These cherry blossoms, blooming so gloriously, only to fall so quickly, also seemed to symbolize life's transience. This was something I often reflected on because my eldest brother had been killed in the war, as had so many other young people. As the cherry blossom petals fluttered gently down around me, I was filled with powerful emotions. A poem came spontaneously to my mind. As soon as I arrived home, I quickly wrote it down. Shinichi spoke with the nostalgia and feeling characteristic of the youthful poet that he was. Falling Cherry Blossoms was the title that Shinichi had given to the poem he had been inspired to write on seeing the cherry trees blooming. I'm going to read out the poem now. Surviving the disaster of war, to bloom cherry blossoms against the blue sky, petals fluttering. Fallen cherry blossoms, blossoms that remain, too shall fall, so people say. Cherry blossoms of youth, how many untold millions, why do you fall? Why do you fall? In the distant southern seas, the fallen cherry blossoms, never blooming to the full, the branches ache. Friends remaining, one day, witnessed by no one, will you fall? Are all things transient or eternal? Without knowing even that, will you fall? O fallen cherry blossoms, blossoms that remain forever, bloom fragrantly in stormy profusion in spring. That's the end of the poem Shinichi Yamamoto wrote. Continuing with the book, life and death, transience and eternity. These were inescapable issues for the 17-year-old Shinichi who grew up during the war. It was from this time that he began his quest for philosophy, a journey that would eventually bring him his path to cross that of Josei Toda and to encounter the great law of life that is the Buddhism of Nichiren Daishonin. Looking up at the cherry trees growing along the edge of the tidal basin, Shinichi said reflectively, "At the very moment I stood gazing at those cherry trees abloom, amid the charred wartime landscape and composed that poem, people here in Washington too were probably savouring the flowering beauty of these cherry trees from Japan. Though our respective countries may have been at war, people in both nations share the capacity to be moved by the sight of beautiful flowers." "Yes, that's so true," said Katsuki Ohara, nodding in agreement. "Visitors to Japan who have seen our cherry blossom extol their unforgettable beauty." "Seeing that many of our fellow members from overseas will come to visit the head temple in the future," Shinichi said, "I'd like to adorn the grounds there by planting many cherry trees. The sight of cherry blossoms in full bloom will be eternally engraved in their hearts as a wonderful memory of their visit to Japan, as well as a symbol of the rich blossoming of the benefit of faith." Shinichi pictured in his mind's eye the spectacular vista of the head temple Taiseikiji, lined with row upon row of cherry trees blooming together in magnificent profusion. In just over 10 years from that time, Shinichi realized this dream. Taiseikiji became a garden filled with beautiful cherry blossoms and presented the members who travelled from all corners of the world to make their pilgrimage there with a breathtaking landscape of dazzling beauty. The day would come, however, when these cherry trees would be felled ruthlessly by a callous high priest who had become the manifestation of the devil of the sixth heaven. Shinichi Yamamoto and the other leaders left Washington, D.C. just after noon, arriving in New York towards nightfall. The next day, they would finally be departing for Sao Paulo, Brazil. They decided to devote that evening to packing and making preparations for their departure. After dinner, the other leaders went out to do some shopping. Shinichi, however, stayed back at the hotel. His condition was still far from satisfactory. If anything, it looked as if it would only grow worse. First, the flight from New York to Sao Paulo was a little over 10 hours. Moreover, the attempts to contact members in the Brazilian city had so far been frustratingly unproductive, leaving them in the dark as to what to expect when they arrived. The journey was certain to be a trying and exhausting one for Shinichi, both physically and mentally. Shinichi took out the picture of his mentor, Josei Toda, that he kept in the inside pocket of his suit jacket. As he lay on the bed, resting his weary body, Shinichi gazed steadily at it. The events of November 19, 1957, some 5 months before Toda's death, came vividly to his mind. It was the day before Toda had collapsed, overtaken by illness. On that day, Shinichi had tried to stop his mentor from leaving for Hiroshima, fully aware that he risked incurring stern rebuke for doing so. Toda was gaunt as he never had been before. His physical strength was at its lowest ebb, and his body showed signs of painful debilitation. It was clear that if he continued to overexert himself, he would be placing his life in jeopardy. As Toda lay resting on the sofa in one of the meeting rooms at the Soka Gakkai headquarters, Shinichi knelt on the floor before him and bowed deeply to his mentor. "Sensei, please cancel your trip to Hiroshima. I beg you," he implored desperately. "Please rest for a while." Toda responded resolutely, "How do you expect me not to go? I have to. As an emissary of the Buddha, I can't turn my back on something once I've decided to do it. I will go even if it kills me. Can't you see that this is the real meaning of faith, Shinichi? What's gotten into you?" Even now, the impassioned tones of his mentor still rang clearly in his ears. "That cry," Shinichi thought to himself, summed up the way a leader of Kosen Rufu should live, a way of life that Toda had shown him through his own example. Brazil was on the opposite side of the world from Japan, one of the countries lying the furthest distance away. When he thought of the many members waiting there to see him, Shinichi knew he absolutely had to go. He resolved to encourage them and to strive with all his might as long as there was still breath left in him. The fighting spirit he had inherited as a disciple of Josei Toda blazed brightly in his heart. Ever since he had fallen ill, Shinichi had made conscious efforts to rest whenever time permitted to regain his health. He did this so that he could go ahead with his plans to visit Brazil. Rising from his bed after some time, Shinichi sat in a chair and began to earnestly chant Daimoku to his Omamori Gohonzon. His prayers were directed single-mindedly towards the goal of tapping powerful life force from the depths of his own being to conquer the devil of illness. He chanted for a long time. When he finished, there was a knock at the door. It was Kiyoshi Jujo, the Soka Gakkai Vice General Director. For several days, Jujo had been debating with himself over whether it might not be wise to stop Shinichi from travelling to Brazil. He sensed that the young Soka Gakkai President's condition was deteriorating daily. In particular, there appeared to be a marked drop in his physical strength and stamina compared to when the group had first arrived in New York. Nor could he help noticing the dark circles under Shinichi's eyes. Jujo had given long, solitary thought to what he should do. He was fully aware that President Yamamoto's visit to Brazil had been planned and organized with careful thought and consideration based on an overall perspective of the future development of the Kosen Rufu movement. He knew, too, that to bring this visit to a halt could easily jeopardize those plans for Kosen Rufu altogether. However, Jujo was convinced that if Shinichi went ahead with his itinerary, he would certainly collapse. His responsibility as one of the leaders accompanying the Soka Gakkai president would not permit him to stand by silently and watch that happen. After giving the matter a great deal of thought, Jujo had discussed it with the other leaders. He now stood outside Shinichi's room, hoping to persuade him to give up the idea of going to Brazil. Shinichi opened the door and invited Jujo in. "Hello, Mr. Jujo," Shinichi said. "Did you get everything you wanted?" "Yes, thank you," Jujo replied. "Where did you go?" "To a department store. I was surprised at the large number of Japanese-made goods they had on display there." Jujo now straightened his posture and began with a rather hesitant expression. "Sensei, I don't know how to say this to you." "Did something happen?" asked Shinichi in concern. Jujo continued with an agonized look. I've come to talk to you about your departure for Brazil tomorrow. To get straight to the point, I would like you to remain here in the United States, Sensei. I think it better that only I and the other leaders should go. Shinji looked at Jujo with surprise. Kiyoshi Jujo summoned his nerve and explained fully. It's obvious to everyone that you're terribly ill. If you push yourself unreasonably, the consequences could be disastrous. If you were to fall seriously ill, the Soka Gakkai would lose its main pillar. I don't dare contemplate what would happen then. I wanted to talk to you about this earlier, but every time I tried to, I just couldn't bring myself to mention it. And I know I'm being terribly presumptuous by doing so now, but I dearly wish to see you get some rest. The other leaders also share my sentiments on this point. The Vice General Director gazed imploringly at Shinichi. Jujo, I'm very grateful, said Shinichi, steadily returning Jujo's gaze. With a burning determination in his eyes, he continued adamantly. I'm going. There are members waiting for me. I absolutely refuse to cancel my plans when everyone is waiting. One of the main purposes of this overseas trip was to visit Brazil. That's why we've come all this way. I can't abandon everything now, when we are almost there. Did President Toda ever once retreat in the middle of a campaign or struggle? I am his disciple. I will go. I will definitely go. If I collapse, then so be it. He spoke with great force, his words ringing with an impassioned fighting spirit. For a moment, there was silence. Shinichi and Jujo looked at each other, their eyes gleaming. Jujo swallowed. He tried to find words to persuade Shinichi, but none were forthcoming. Having heard the young president's heartfelt resolve, he knew there was nothing more he could say. And when he realized this, he felt a burning surge of emotion rise within him. President Yamamoto, said Jujo, deeply moved and with tears in his eyes. I understand. Please forgive me. I am determined to accompany you always, no matter what or where. A smile now returned to Shinichi's face. Let's go. Let's go to the end of the ocean, on President Toda's behalf. A serene picture of the new and unknown land of Brazil had already emerged within Shinichi's mind. Chapter 5. Pioneers. The jet airliner broke through the thick cloud cover and rose powerfully into the clear sky above. Its silver wings glinted brilliantly in the sunlight, while below a sea of clouds stretched out in all directions. The ascent was somehow reminiscent of the struggles of the members who, as bold champions of justice, fought their way through obstacles and hardships to soar serenely, like a noble eagle, into the victorious and joyful skies of Kōsun Rūfu. Pan American Flight 203, with Shinichi Yamamoto and the other leaders on board, left New York shortly after 10 a.m. on October 18, 1960, destined for Sao Paulo, Brazil. Sometime later, the clouds parted to reveal the beautiful azure waters of the Caribbean sparkling below. But this was to prove short-lived. Soon, clouds obscured the ocean once more and the plane began to be buffeted wildly by what appeared to be the effects of a hurricane. The turbulence was particularly rough on Shinichi, whose physical exhaustion was already at a critical level. The group had received almost no information on what they could expect to find in Sao Paulo. After their visit had been officially decided upon, the staff of the Overseas Affairs section of the Soka Gakkai headquarters had sent several letters to the members who were serving as the organization's main contacts in Brazil, but had received no response. That was not surprising, given that of the many letters the headquarters sent, only one had actually reached the members, and even that had been as late as September 20th. Although the local members forwarded a reply right away, Shinichi and the others had already left for overseas by the time it arrived in Japan. Nevertheless, From the one letter that had reached them, the local members in Brazil learned the group's arrival date and flight number. They thus spread the happy news of the Soka Gakkai president's imminent visit among their fellow members. Before their departure from New York as well, Shinichi and the others had sent a telegram to Sao Paulo, but again had received no response. It had taken the local members quite a bit of time to arrange for an international wire to be sent in reply. It, too, eventually arrived after the group had already departed for Brazil. The only information that Shinichi and the others had concerning the conditions in Brazil was that the membership numbered some 100 households spread throughout the country and that the members there had held several discussion meetings. Since Brazil's national language was Portuguese, the in-flight announcements were in Portuguese and English. Neither Shinichi nor any of the others could speak Portuguese, and Nagayasu Masaki, who could speak English, had remained in New York to await their return. This leg of their trip was filled with constant uncertainty, like trying to feel one's way blindly in the dark. They felt anxious and alone. Shinichi looked haggard and pale. Kiyoshi Jujo, who sat next to him on the plane, peered anxiously at his face and asked, "How are you feeling?" "I'm fine. Please don't worry," said Shinichi, offering him a reassuring smile. In olden days, Christian missionaries would often sail across the ocean, being rocked and tossed about for weeks on end, journeying to unknown shores without knowing the language of the natives. Then all alone, they would strive to propagate their faith. "Even though I may be feeling a little under the weather, compared to what they had to go through, I am quite fortunate to travel like this by plane." "Yes, well," said Jujo, at a loss for something else to say. "By the way," Shinichi continued, "I've been thinking about this for some time and I'd like to establish a chapter in Brazil." "Establish a chapter?" exclaimed a stunned Jujo, as if wishing to confirm that he had heard Shinichi correctly. "Yes, the first chapter outside of Japan. I realize that the membership in Brazil is still small. However, the history, culture, and the temperament of South Americans are very different from North Americans. We must think of South America as distinct and separate. Brazil will become the cornerstone for our activities in this region. I also believe that this will heighten the local members' self-awareness and above all strengthen their unity." It was not the idea of establishing a chapter in Brazil that had surprised Jujo. Rather, he had been taken aback by Shinichi's powerful sense of mission, his tenacity of purpose. For, in spite of his dire health and being confined in a plane that continued to pitch and heave violently in the turbulence, Shinichi calmly outlined his sincere hopes and vision for the Kosan Rufu movement in Brazil. The plane landed in the early evening at an airport surrounded by palm trees. According to the itinerary they had received from the travel agency, Shinichi and his party were not scheduled to arrive in Sao Paulo until 10:45 p.m. It was obvious, then, that they had not landed there. An announcement came over the PA system, but the group from Japan had no idea what was being said and were left completely in the dark as to where they were or why they had landed. In the row behind Shinichi, Chūhei Yamadaira, glancing about restlessly, said to Aisuki Akizuki, who was sitting next to him, "Where do you think we are?" Aisuke Akizuki, using the few words of English that he knew, asked some of the passengers sitting near them where they were and the reason for their landing. He repeated the same question 5 or 6 times before someone finally seemed to understand what he was trying to ask. They replied in English, but Akizuki could not understand the full gist of their explanation. Nevertheless, he managed to catch the name Port of Spain and the word gas. Aisuki Akizuki took out the English dictionary he had packed in his hand luggage and looked up the word gas. He found that in American usage it also meant gasoline. Next, he pulled out a world map and tried to locate Port of Spain. This, he discovered, was the main city of the island of Trinidad, lying off the northeastern coast of Venezuela in South America. Akizuki promptly conveyed this information to Shinichi, who was sitting in the row in front of him. "Sensei, we appear to be in Port of Spain, Trinidad, and I think we've made a stop for refueling." "So, we are in Trinidad. This island is famous in Europe as one of those considered to have been discovered by Christopher Columbus," remarked Shinichi. Shortly after the plane resumed its flight to Brazil, it was enfolded in the dark embrace of nightfall. As they flew over the Guiana Highlands, the turbulence worsened, buffeting the plane violently. Some of the passengers had turned pale with nausea. It was after 11 p.m. Sao Paulo time when the plane finally landed. "Finally, we've made it to Sao Paulo," Chuhei Yamadaira said, then yawned heavily. An announcement came over the PA system. After listening to the English, Akizuki said to Kiyoshi Jujo, "It seems to me they're saying this is Brasilia and that we've landed here because of some kind of problem with the plane." "Yes, I also got the impression they said something like that," Jujo agreed. The passengers then started to leave the plane. Shinichi and the other leaders also got off, but they had no idea where to go. An airport employee stood in front of the terminal building. He appeared to be of Asian descent. Jujo tentatively addressed him in Japanese. "We are going as far as Sao Paulo. What plane do we take?" The clerk replied with a smile. "In that case, it's the plane next to this one." He spoke Japanese. Everyone gave a sigh of relief. The next leg of their journey was by propeller plane. By the time they finally reached Sao Paulo, it was after 1:30 in the morning, more than 2 hours behind their original schedule. Their entire journey from New York to Sao Paulo, which was 2 hours ahead of New York time, had taken around 13 hours. We will stop there today and we will continue to read Pioneers in our next reading. I will see you then. Have a good day.